Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, Jack, we're rating Avatar, The Way of Water, Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, and Corsage. But before we get onto those, what else have you been watching this week?
Well, I think like the rest of the world, I've been watching the Harry and Meghan Netflix documentary. I'm only one episode in because that was all I could take for the minute. I think I don't really know how I feel about it, apart from it's addictive watching, but also I dislike everything it stands for and what it is. But that's kind of like the royal family. Yeah. I can't help watching it and getting involved with the drama, even if morally, you know, I don't really believe that these people were chosen by God. But let's not get into that. It's interesting to tell you. Have you watched it, Jane?
I have. I've watched 2.5 episodes, and I think it's just fascinating viewing just from a sort of media perspective of the narrative that is being crafted and shown to us, and trying to work out what the intent is of that. And, you know, the sort of gossipy element of it. And just that this is unprecedented that no royal has granted this much sort of casual access to their life so far. So it feels like something that I watch in a homework way rather than I'm watching it because I'm actually that interested in it. But I don't know about you, Jack, but we are the media. We are part of the media. And so there's a lot of like everyone in this keeps talking about how awful the media is as this sort of catch-all, and that this is the big bad. So I'm just interested in, as we go along, whether that will get more granular about what we're talking about. Because I do think that sort of when people throw around accusations like that, that the media is all bad, and it puts all forms of media into one basket, that it's disregarding some really important sort of outlets that, you know, watch and question and measure and report and all of those sort of aspects of it. And to sort of just massively say all media is bad feels a bit weird. But then we're in that era anyway, aren't we, that media are, we are all bad guys. We are bad, apparently.
I'm so entrenched in being part of the media. I find a lot of those claims quite laughable because it feels so painting everyone with one brush, but also just a fundamental misunderstanding of how many of these publications work. I used to work at The Independent, which was a newspaper, and then went all online, and we were in like the same building as the Daily Mail and the Metro. And, you know, you would get to know some of these people who were members of the media and would write for publications that I couldn't personally write for and disagree with. But, you know, they're very different, and a lot of them are well intentioned people who perhaps editors or just someone at the top will change the words or do something. There's so much granular, you're right, stuff there that needs exploring. And that's why I find it quite funny in a way that you can be like, oh my God, all these people are just, they're just evil, but they're not, they're people as well. And there are some major issues with the media, with the paparazzi, especially jumping in front of people from bushes and invading privacy. But at the same time, I guess what I find interesting is how much in this documentary Harry and Meghan are putting out there themselves. And I guess that's the difference, isn't it? They're choosing to put this out there. We're choosing to put a photo of
biomedia.
Like, that's what I find odd is, I mean, I guess away from the media chat, but just the idea of putting yourself out there to that degree. Here's a photo of my like husband when we first met, and he's, you know, lying in bed looking at me nicely or whatever, and I'm like, I don't need to see this is very odd. It's very exposing. Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff going on here, a lot of talking points. I think it's, you could do a whole podcast just talking about that, and especially,
I mean, and it's fascinating, it's absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
The whole aspect of it, and then obviously the media's response to it as well, and the various headlines it's generated. So it's really interesting. As interesting as any film, I would say. So, and it also feels it's that classic thing, isn't it, that you feel like you have to see it because everybody is talking about it.
Listen, you're not going to like what I'm going to say next, Jane, but you said as good as any film, but the World Cup has been great.
There's that
been
too.
So good.
Yeah.
I feel like that's been taking up a lot of my time watching all the, well, we're on semi-finals at the moment now that we're recording, and there was a solid match yesterday with Argentina getting through. Oh, there's been so much good drama. And the England game versus France, full of twists and turns. That's probably been taking up more of my time.
Yes, and is as dramatic as any screenplay, I would suggest. Okay, so should we move on then and talk about, you know, there's a actual big film out. There's a big film out. It's time to dive into this.
Why do you come to us?
I just want to keep my family safe.
Treat them as our brothers and sisters. Teach them our ways.
Keep up, Forest Boy!
If you want to live here, you have to ride.
Let's do it.
Just breathe. Breathe.
So this is Avatar, The Way of Water. Ah, Jack, for someone who has no concept of Avatar or what's gone on before, tell us a little bit about the James Cameron Avatar phenomenon.
Well, over a decade ago, this little film called Avatar came out, and it made a bit at the box office. I believe we're nearing the 3 billion mark after various re-releases and such, but that film took us to the world of Pandora, which was filled with these native blue people called the Na'vi. And in that film, we saw Jake Sully, who was a human, going into one of those creatures. Now, in this movie, Jake Sully is one of those creatures fully. He's no longer an avatar. There aren't really many avatars in this movie, so the name doesn't make as much sense as it used to. But yes, we're back in the world of Pandora and Avatar, The Way of Water. We're back with Jake Sully and Zoe Saldana's Neytiri, one of the natives as well. They now have a family. They have two sons and a daughter and an adopted daughter who is somehow the real daughter of the dead avatar belonging to Dr. Grace, who is played by Sigourney Weaver in the original. And here that daughter is also played by Sigourney Weaver. It's a bit odd. And they also have an adopted human son called Spider, who is left behind by the humans after they left Pandora in the original. That's a lot to take in. We'll breathe. That's like the first 30 seconds of the movie.
And so then what happens?
And then the plot starts and the humans are back on Pandora. They're looking for a new homeworld after ravaging Earth. And now that they're back on Pandora, the natives, led by Jake still, are fighting back. Also, Stephen Lang's character, Colonel Quaritch, is here as well. He may have died in the last movie, but he's back and he's blue now because his memories are now in a Na'vi body. And the humans, who are led by a cameo role by Edie Falco, who is best known for The Sopranos, they want to mine the world for its resource and basically take it over. And again, that's probably the next 15 minutes after the first 5 minutes I just talked about. This is a long, long film.
This is 3 hours and 11 minutes, right?
Yes. And I would say there's a whole lot of plot very quickly in this movie, a lot of exposition. And then, you know, the movie's called The Way of Water. You're expecting to see some water. You get it and you get a lot of it, but only an hour into the film. And then it's vibes. Then we're just doing underwater vibes. We're just kind of hanging out with whales. We're having a little swim along. You know, the Sullies they go and meet the Metcaina clan, with one of them played by Kate Winslet. And yeah, they're just swimming around.
And these are the water people. I mean, basically the Na'vi are the forest people, and Jake Sully and family escaped in order to protect the forest people because the sky people, i.e. the humans, are coming for them. But they just take that fight to another tribe, which seems a little selfish, but they do. And off they go to the water people to learn the way of water.
There's a lot going on, but at the same time,
not very much at all.
Not much going.
Come on then, Jack. Any good?
I liked it. I really enjoyed being on this world again. I enjoyed being transported back to it. I enjoyed the underwater stuff. I thought the vibes were fun and cool. And I thought the last third, especially the action that was going down, was really great. It played like James Cameron, greatest hits. And, you know, we're not just talking aliens and the action stuff. We're talking Titanic as well.
Titanic, yeah. And Abyss.
I mean, and Abyss. These huge references to all these films from his filmography. I thought it was really, really stunning. It does take a long time to get there, though. And you also have this weird frame rate stuff going on that I found really distracting in places.
So it's got a very high frame rate for the action, and then other places, you know, it drops. Why didn't that work for you? I mean, for me, it was a bit weird because it felt like the whole thing felt like a video game, just watching a video game. We should also mention, obviously, this is in 3D. Did that work for you, that high frame rate?
In places it did. When it was just CGI characters, it really did. I thought it was really absorbing. It's playing at 48 frames per second, so it looks silky smooth. And especially the underwater stuff, it looks incredible. I really was transported there. But then, the moment any human character comes on screen...
It's 24 frames. We're down to 24.
But it's not, though, because there are parts of it where kind of Spider, this human character, would come on and it would feel like watching a video game, but then seeing some just a human come into it. And you would be like, what is going on? This is so, it looks really weird.
Yeah.
And so for people who don't really understand, I guess, what that means and the smoothness would look like. If you remember back when The Hobbit first came out,
yeah,
Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy, he did the same thing. But the whole movie was in this 48 frames per second thing, and it made the sets, I remember at the time thinking that, you know, the sets looked really suddenly really cheap. They just looked really odd when they weren't. This was a mega budget movie, and it's not the same here. The technology has obviously moved on and the CGI stuff really does look great, but the moment a fluid human comes on screen, you're so not used to it.
Yeah.
It just looks really weird. I mean, we saw it again with Gemini Man recently with Will Smith, which just looked really weird as well. And it's distracting, I found. Because I would have been more into it, I think, if I'd just watched it in normal, like a normal film.
Yeah, I mean, the frame rate is non-negotiable. That his frame rate is in everything. You can watch this in 2D or in 3D. So if you find those glasses uncomfortable... over 3 hours, they're not going to get any more comfortable, are they? But I do think that, you know, the 3D is worth the experience. I mean, that's the thing for me. I found this whole film would have been better as a theme park experience. I'd have enjoyed this if I'd gone in and had an hour of this, of like swimming underwater and experiencing it, and had some water squirted at me and wind in my hair, and it was an experiential thing. But for me, it felt like it was 3 hours of the same thing. But when it worked, as you say, when we're sort of like vibing under the water and there's fish swimming past and jellyfish and floaty things, and there's music playing, it's kind of nice, isn't it? It's like having had an edible.
I watched this on, speaking of the World Cup, it was during the England game that we won. I can't remember who we were playing because I didn't watch it, because I was watching this instead. And the day after, I was waiting for a junket, and one of the other journalists said to me, they were like, this would be an amazing film to be on edibles watching, yeah, super high. And it was like, yeah.
We're not condoning drug use, but...
No.
But yeah, it felt trippy, right? It felt sort of like this other sort of worldly experience. And that's great. But narratively, let's talk about narrative here. This is very repetitive. It feels like the same narrative three times over, one for each hour, which is essentially Jake Sully saying to his kids, stay here, don't get into trouble. The kids don't, and he has to rescue them. Three times over in different scenarios. Which I was just like, can these kids just listen to their dad for once? I mean, I understand that this is where it's taking it, but it just felt incredibly repetitive to me. Did you enjoy the arc for these characters?
Yes and no. I didn't mind the family dynamic, and I saw it as more being repetitive with the original Avatar.
Yeah.
Because it follows a lot of the same story beats. We even get, you know, the hair tangling with the tree that lets you see people from the past and
you
stuff.
You get it in coral this time.
You get it underwater this time. You get Jake having to learn how to use a new animal with his hair tendrils again and see him training with that. You see them adapting to a new surrounding. It's just now it's the underwater people rather than in the forest, which is fine. But I watched the original in preparation for this because I hadn't seen it for a decade since cinemas. And I was really struck by how much of it is similar and how much I probably wouldn't recommend watching the first one if you're going to go to the cinema to see this one. Just let those memories be nice memories of seeing that original
wash over
film.
You, literally.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because I do think this is a huge cinema experience. I still think and would recommend going to see it, especially if you did enjoy the first one, because it's kind of a repeat. But now, rather than stepping into the forest world of Pandora and being like, whoa, we're stepping into the water world and being like, whoa, I do think the last third makes up for a lot of what comes beforehand. I really, really rated the action and thought it was James Cameron at some of his best work, some of his best action work. I mean, there's a lot of story threads in here that are going to pay off very obviously in a sequel as well.
Yes, and it's left wide open for that. I mean, there is a certain character that does something ridiculous that feels completely out of character purely to ensure that more narrative trauma will come that we can watch in another film.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the character who definitely has so many seeds planted for their future story without revealing anything really about the character would be, for me, it seemed like Sigourney Weaver's teenage character, Kiri.
Yeah.
This strangeness going on in the background with her, but never really addressing it and just letting it happen. I mean, how convinced were you by Sigourney Weaver as a teenager?
Not. I mean, her voice is so well known. We know it so well. It just feels weird. Her sort of saying, hey, guys, you know, hey, stop that. And sort of, you know, that's Sigourney and you know her entire past of, you know, all of the films that she's done. You know that it's her. So it didn't work for me. Whereas, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, I struggled to understand which one was Kate Winslet. This was another part of it for me. This one, I couldn't tell the Navi apart, really. And I didn't feel like they looked enough like the people who were playing them for me to really understand. So I was like, is that Kate Winslet? And so it felt like very strange that she was in it. And also, let's talk about this, Jack. We talked about this in the office. All of the cast have talked about being in real water tanks, doing breath holds, learning to dive, and that Kate Winslet broke, you know, Tom Cruise's breath hold record with a 7-minute dive. Why? Did you see evidence of why that informed this? Like how that helped this? This is all CGI. Like, why does anyone have to be even wet?
I mean, James Cameron has spoken about wanting to capture the real underwater feel of the Navi being underwater. So whether that's the way the hair flows and things like that. And there are obviously many sequences underwater. But yes, agreed, they are all CGI. There are no human characters who really have to hold their breath. And even when the human characters do, it's more realistic because they're all wearing things on their faces to be able to do so.
I don't understand it.
You could argue it's just for the realness to be able to see how someone's hair flows. I mean, Cameron again has spoken about not wanting people to wear oxygen masks and things because you could see the air bubbles flowing up. So even the cameramen on these films had to hold their breath the entire time they were filming underwater in these tubs. It's quite a feat, but at the same time, you've covered it all up in CGI. So it makes it feel slightly redundant in a way, though I do feel that some of that authenticity comes through. I mean, speaking about some of the characters who you can't tell them apart, I mean, Kate Winslet's only in this for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
She's hardly in it. She doesn't really make a huge impact. Zoe Saldana's Neytiri, I felt, was highly underused. It feels like maybe we're setting up for a more female-focused motherly sequel, whereas this one focuses on fathers. And you can see the themes here as well between many of the characters, especially Jake Sully, obviously. I actually thought Sam Worthington was really great in this. I thought his performance came through the CGI. And it was really impressive. And we haven't seen him on screens. Well, I guess Clash of the Titans.
let's not think about that.
This has been written about at length, how he was set up to be this mega movie star after Avatar, the highest grossing movie of all time, and then didn't really do anything. But back in this, he's really good and really solid. And some of the kids' performances are really great too. It's just a really hard film, I find, to love and to be like, this is really great, because we're talking a lot about negatives, but I did have a really good time with this and in the cinema. But it's really easy to pick up on small things, whether it's Sigourney Weaver playing a teenager or the tails on the...
I hate the tails. I find them horrible. Why? There's so many bums in this. Blue bums everywhere.
There's a lot of blue in this film. There are some really strange kind of cameos. I mean, Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords is in this for 5 minutes again. There's just some really odd choices. And I think it almost probably would have been better served if we didn't know that there was another one coming. Because with the knowledge that there are potentially four Avatar sequels, it feels like not only are we sprinkling in a lot of things, but we're holding stuff back, some of the exciting stuff back, from, because we know there's all these movies coming. Although I would say, you know, never bet against James Cameron. Obviously knows how to do sequels and he knows how to do franchises. So fingers crossed that three, that's definitely happening because it's already filmed. Start of four has already filmed two. Although the rest of four, which apparently would happen after a time jump, and then five, they're not officially confirmed by Disney yet. And it all depends on how this film does. So if you love Avatar, make sure you go see it.
They need the box office numbers on that opening weekend, don't they? Because Jim's poised. He's there ready to go based on those numbers. I saw somebody say on social that this was like a screensaver for 3 hours. And I have to say, that's kind of how it felt for me. It just was stuff to look at whilst I shoved popcorn in my mouth. I didn't feel emotionally connected to any of it. And there was a weird lack of peril in this. The only things that really seemed to die were fish. And that actually was probably the most sort of engaging part for me. This moment when the themes of sort of ecological themes came into play about what are we doing to our oceans and how are we treating the fish and the animals and the creatures within them. And that felt engaging. Then, of course, you've got the theme of, you know, colonialism, which is a very huge thing in this. What are we doing as a world in terms of other realms and as you say, mining other realms for our own good. But also this idea of, they've called it Dances with Wolves in space, Avatar before. This is essentially Dances with Wolves in the sea. Do you think that those were done well, elegantly handled?
Yeah, I think they weren't overly heavy-handed. Some of it was pretty obvious. The fact that humans are back on Pandora because Earth is completely broken and stuff. It's, you know, it's tried and tested tropes, I guess. But I think it's effective. And I think it's obviously a love of James Cameron, the ocean and conservatism, everything like that. And he does it well. He knows what he's saying. He knows the right message to produce. Does spending 20 minutes hanging out, swimming around with an outcast whale make for a great movie and narrative? Maybe not. I think you're right. I think the idea of it being a roller coaster ride and kind of just a vibes time is probably the right way to look at it. But I'm not against that. I'm not against that. So, but yes, the messaging is, I thought, done well. I think it's important for a big blockbuster to say something important that is necessary for the times. You know, when was the last time a big Avengers movie said something as important as this? I'm not really sure. But then Marvel movies are set out to do something different, and that's like purely entertainment. And I'm sure James Cameron would argue that this isn't just entertainment, it's something more than that.
Yeah.
I don't know. What did you think, Jane?
I didn't feel anything for it. I was like, ooh, look at the fishies. That was the whole point of it. I was like, look at the fishies. I kind of want to go diving. And when can I book a beach holiday? Those were my thoughts whilst watching it. I didn't feel emotionally engaged with it.
It's tricky because I felt more ties to them. Maybe that was because I watched the first one just recently. Maybe I'd go back on my former point and say, yeah, I actually do watch the first one.
And then connect with them.
Yeah, get connected to the Navi.
But also, if you have an aversion to people who say bruh and bro and cuz with every sentence, then this is going to rub you up the wrong way, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there were a few similarities with the Fast and Furious films throughout, I found, especially the use of the word family.
Family.
Many, many, many times. Yeah. And some of the mindlessness of it. I don't know. But I love the Fast and Furious films. So
you do. You love it. Absolutely love it. I mean, nobody drank a Corona underwater, so, you know, we're not going that far. But yeah, family.
Well, apparently Vin Diesel's in the sequel, one of the sequels. So we're really bringing the faster.
We're crossing the streams. So are we saying to people, go and see this? I mean, I think much as I disliked it generally, I still would recommend that people go and see it because everyone's going to want to have an opinion on it. It is an experience, whether that's good or bad. And, you know, it's cinema on its biggest, most bombastic scale, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And also, you know, this is a sequel to the highest grossing movie of all time, directed by James Cameron, that's come 13 years later. I don't know, there's not been a film as momentous as this since, well, I guess Top Gun Maverick. You know, it's on that
changing level in terms of changing the game,
you know, scale and the amount that's going to be talked about. It will be playing for weeks and weeks and weeks in cinemas, and everyone's going to be talking about the box office numbers for a long time. But at the center, there is this movie that is at the center of all this discussion. And for anyone who's a film buff or just interested in cinema, it's going to be the film to see this holiday season. So yes, I think it's definitely worth going to see, even if it's just to have an opinion.
Indeed. Okay, so that is Avatar 2, The Way of Water, and it is out in cinemas in 2D and 3D on Friday. Right, so from one starry sequel to another now, it's this.
I've invited you all to my island.
Hi.
Because tonight, a murder will be committed. My murder.
Once you're dead, will we still be able to talk to you?
Yeah, I'm not playing dead the whole weekend, dude.
This is truly delightful.
Across the island, I've hidden clues. You will have to closely observe each other. If anyone can name the killer, that person wins our game. Any questions?
Halle Berry. That has a kick.
Oh my God, what happened?
So this is Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery. Jack, it's not going on from Knives Out. It's a totally different new story. In a nutshell, in a onion, can you describe what's going on here?
Well, it is a brand new story from Rian Johnson, but he's brought back Daniel Craig's Detective Benoit Blanc. This time, it's an Elon Musk-esque tech bro boss called Miles Brown, who's played by Edward Norton, who's invited all of his close friends to enjoy a murder mystery at his private island, with the end result apparently being Miles's own death and the guests having to work out who killed him. So those friends, they're an assortment of A-list actors, essentially. There's Kate Hudson, who's a party girl turned sweatpants designer, and her assistant, played by Jessica Henwick. There's Dave Bautista as an Alex Jones type men's activist, streamer, tech, like bro person, and his girlfriend, played by Madeline Klein. Leslie Odom Jr. is there as a scientist who works directly with Norton's character to create some new clean energy source. There's Catherine Hahn as a governor running for Senate. And finally, we have Janelle Monáe as the woman who helped Miles create his fortune and his company. So Benoit's also invited along to kind of up the ante on this murder mystery game they're all playing, because why not invite the world's best detective? And of course, there are twists and turns and all that kind of stuff along the way. There's a really huge literal glass onion. We won't go into spoilers here, but there are people who, surprising deaths, a surprising, well, arguably surprising murderer, and a denouement at the end that I personally didn't feel was anywhere near as satisfying as the one in the first movie, though I did enjoy quite a lot of the characters along the way here. What do you think, Jane?
And there's some very satisfying glass smashing.
There is a lot of glass smashing.
Which I thought this must have been the most fun day on set for the people involved in this. I would have loved to have done that much smashing. Didn't find the film a smasher, though, did you?
I enjoyed lots of the characters and some of the banter. But I did feel that some of the talking points, especially those, you know, as I kind of hinted at in talking about the characters, you know, the tech bros, the Elon Musk type people, it all feels very on the nose and perhaps at times a bit too smug and self-knowing and distracting in a way that takes away from the actual mystery at hand. especially because the actual mystery isn't perhaps as strong as it could have been. Whereas with most murder mystery movies, I love watching them again and being able to work out all the details and go like, oh, that's what they were doing there. That was what the murderer was doing. But this movie, they literally go back and they replay half the movie from a different character's perspective.
Yeah.
So you can go, oh, that's what they were doing there. That's what they were doing there. And that feels like it's basically saying the mystery was either you couldn't work it out yourself, or because it was too complicated, or that the mystery's not strong enough. And so we have to go back and really lay it out for you and just to build up the runtime. And I would say it was a mixture of those two. And that side of it, the moment it got to that point, I kind of just clocked out of it. I was really enjoying it up to that point. And then I went, oh, this is actually a really odd decision to go into this minuscule level, especially of replaying like parts from the movie and seeing it again from the same angles, basically, in many parts. It was just odd. So I don't know. I enjoyed some of the characters, but you know, these types of movies live and die on the mystery, don't they?
Yeah. And I have to say, I guessed who it was quite early on because of a quite ham-fisted pass off of an item that I noticed immediately how that item had been passed to another person and then knew exactly who had done it. So then when it was revealed, it was like, oh. And so that was kind of disappointing for me. But maybe that's just because I was watching that particular moment in a forensic way and maybe caught something I wasn't supposed to. I don't know. But that sort of disappointed me. But yeah, the thing I find about this, and I found about Knives Out as well, found it a little bit smug and knowing and a bit, aren't we clever? Aren't we having a good time? And it looks like they had the most amazing time. That cast in Greece during lockdown, having a wonderful time on that beautiful island. Good for you guys. But the sort of script feels so arch and so knowing that I kind of found it went bordered into just annoying for me. Just things like when Janelle Monáe's character starts talking about Harriet Tubman and you're like, well, I know you were in Harriet, so ha ha ha. And also just very of a time, the jokes and the sort of the ripping the piss out of influencers or, you know, the sort of Dave Bautista character felt weirdly like they wouldn't age well, that this was of a specific time. And maybe that's what you want from a film that really does say COVID times about it. But it didn't sit well with me. I didn't love it. And I went premiere. Can I just say, I went to the premiere and I sat next to Daniel Craig, who laughed like a drain throughout it. So he really enjoys it, but I didn't laugh as much as Daniel. Sorry, Dan.
Oh, I mean, I'm glad he had a good time. And it really does feel like the cast had an amazing time making this, because it's on an incredible island. The cinematography is really stunning in this as well. But I do agree about many of the jokes, and I also felt strange seeing people on screen wearing masks still and stuff like that. And there's this really kind of nonchalant way they dismiss how they're all hanging out together without having to continue wearing masks, with Ethan Hawke's character involved.
Yes.
And it just felt really odd. It really struck me as being like, wow, this is kind of contrived and I don't know if I like that. And talking about the humor, a lot of it's feels like Twitter humor from the time as well. It feels like we've spent a lot of time online and we're going to make a lot of online jokes now because no one's out in the real world. And I guess right now releasing the movie, it still feels a bit dated.
Mm.
It feels like if this had come out last Christmas, I could totally see it working and being very, very kind of the times, of the moment. You know, they mention like NFTs and things like that in the movie.
Yeah. And it's just like, no one cares about that anymore. That's been and gone. No. Yes. But if you enjoyed Knives Out, it is more of the same. You know, you do get a starry cast. It is like those, you know, sort of Agatha Christie's that they used to do back in the sort of 70s where, you know, there was, here's David Niven, off he goes. And here's Bette Davis. You know, like, it is good. But if you like something a bit more meaty and less arch, then it might just grate.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who have really enjoyed this movie. Interestingly, it feels like there's a slight American-UK divide in the humor, that maybe the humor is more tailored to Americans and that side. I don't know what's actually in there. I don't know what that means, but I thought I'd put it out there. But it was not on. I really enjoyed the first Knives Out, and it was not on level with that movie. And I think the whole mystery in the first one, the characters, everything just felt fuller and more timeless as well. Whereas this felt so of a moment that it needs to be released now. Otherwise, it's just going to date really badly. And we're going to watch it in a year's time and be like, oh, God, that was a time, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's been at cinemas. So it's obviously courting the awards season. And now it's going to Netflix. I think that's a good place for it.
Knives Out dropping on Netflix, especially around Christmas time. It's a great movie to throw on the telly when the whole family's there, maybe had a few drinks. Everyone can have a chat through the movie about who did it, what's going on, that kind of thing. I think it will be, that will be a lot of fun. Or which is kind of strange to say about films. Normally I'd be, don't say a word during a film. But at the same time, this is the sort of movie that invites discussion. I mean, my main memories of watching murder mysteries and the Agatha Christie stuff is like reruns on ITV.
Yes.
Midsummer Murders and everyone having a little chat and cup of tea and watching these. So I think it definitely suits the home environment. I think it's going to do super well for Netflix. Obviously, it's disappointing that it didn't have a longer cinema run initially because it was only out for a week. But I still think this is going to be a great place for it and one of the rare movies where home viewing really is going to be very helpful for it. And I think people might prefer it watching at home, being able to have that discussion rather than, you know, because if you're paying super close attention like you obviously were, Jane, and notice the minor detail that
you know the bits that I'm talking about.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, if you're watching it on Netflix, you can pause it, can't you, after one of the beats has happened and be like, guys, who do we think it is now? And this can be a sort of communal chatty experience that is probably exactly what you want at Christmas.
And whoever gets it wrong can have a drink at the end as a forfeit. I don't condone drinking games. That was we'll ignore that.
You can do that with a juice or a nice cup of tea. Lovely cup of tea and a mince pie. There you go. So
it's a good cup of tea movie.
It is a good cup of tea movie. Okay, so if you fancy that, Glass Onion hits Netflix on the 23rd of December. Perfect for Christmas. Right. Final film now for this week. It's time to get regal. It's this.
A lion doesn't lose sleep over the opinion of sheep. I love to look at you looking at me. Sie ist ein Buch für mich. Auf jeder Seite steht ein Rätsel.
So, this is Corsage. Jack. Not about a little flowery thing you put on your wrist when you're going to prom. What is it about?
So, yes, Corsage is about Vicky Krieps playing the Empress Elizabeth of Austria, and she's also the Queen of Hungary, also known to those who watched the recent Netflix series called The Empress as Sisi.
Yes.
But this is a dramatization of her life that plays more loosely with the facts. So the story is essentially the Empress's breakdown. She's under constant scrutiny for her looks, in particular her weight, and she tries to fit into these tightening corsets to go on royal duties. She has an undiagnosed eating disorder. She has a childlike demeanor that her own children see as kind of not befitting a queen or an empress. She has these loyal maids around her, some who are friends, and she has, the empress has this desire to be free and be loved and be queen to the people, but she's selfish and she's a loving mother and a terrible mother, and she goes away and leaves Hungary and doesn't do her duty, and then she comes back and her husband's both doting on her and then despises her, and it's all these multitudes of this woman and this character, and it leads to this ending that's historically very inaccurate but sadly somehow feels inevitable for the person presented in this movie. So it's worth noting that a lot of this is informed by a tragedy in her past, which is the death of her daughter in infancy. And interestingly, the movie actually also takes place before the death of the daughter was a real tragedy, but another real tragedy in the Empress's life, which was the death of her oldest son at the age of 30. And that was the event in reality that led to her always wearing black. her entire life.
Yes.
But this movie takes place just before then and kind of concentrates on this 1 year in her life.
And, you know, she's also very sort of historically important because she was assassinated as well. And it's not going into that at all either. This is literally a segment of her life, just looking in to her sort of psychological balance that she's trying to keep. And also, do you not think that there's a massive sort of correlation between this and Princess Diana? We're sort of looking at a woman who's scrutinized by the press and by the people for her fashion, her hair, her weight, her love life, and the pressure that puts on a person and how you navigate that, which I found really interesting. Did you like this?
I'm not wholly sure. I was really, really enjoying it. And then as it kind of went on and on, it stopped working for me at a point, I think. I didn't actually like the ending particularly. I thought it was trying to be clever and play with history, but I just didn't like where it was going. And it, you know, it felt inevitable, but at the same time, I didn't like that feeling of where it was going. So I don't know. I feel really mixed on it. I thought she's great in it.
She's great in everything, isn't she?
Yeah, she really is. And the look of the movie is stunning. You know, there are some really, really beautiful shots in it, but I ended up getting annoyed with her as a character in places. And I think it probably didn't help to return to the beginning of this podcast that I watched it after I'd watched this episode of Harry and Meghan, and my sympathies for royals and royalty really dived. And I could totally see, you know, the comparison to Princess Diana, and I could totally see why this is part of the zeitgeist right now. You know, there's a reason that Netflix show came out exactly the same time as this, basically. Yeah, my sympathies for royals is just completely diminished, especially when, you know, this woman's kind of turning down all this really nice food. And I was just hungry and I was like, why aren't you eating that delicious looking chicken? But I get it. I get it from, you know, she can't because she's bullied by, you know, the press and everyone like that. But I don't know. I feel like, get out, go do what you need to do. She was still riding her horses and living this free life and having affairs and all this kind of stuff. She's a really complicated...
Okay, I'm going to take task with you because it's not as simple as that. This isn't about being royal. This is about being a woman in that particular time, and that there are still elements of that today. This is about, you know, a woman who is not allowed to eat everything she wants because her appearance is what people think of her. That's how they think of her as a woman. You know, you say she's having affairs, but she cannot, but her husband can. She can't just get out and do stuff, Jack. She's a woman in, you know, in a certain time period that's laced into a corset daily. She's got an eating disorder. That's why she's not eating a chicken. And that's not because she's a royal brat. That's because she's psychologically damaged and she has to fit into a 16-inch corset, which is insanely small. I mean, she was famous for her very, very long hair. She was very famous for her tiny, tiny waist. And she has to maintain that because that's what recommends her as a woman in the world. Nothing to do with her intellect. She tries to tell her husband, you know, could I give you some advice about running the country? Could I give you some advice? And he's like, no, love, you're here to be decorous. That's it. Go off and put your hair on your head, get your corset strapped in. That's your role. So I think this is much more about feminism than it is about royalty. I think you might have missed the point.
I'm glad you said all that, because I do agree, obviously, with everything you said. But I also think that, therefore, my frustrations are more with society and the pressures we put on people and all that kind of stuff rather than her, because I found her absolutely fascinating as a character. But I do find that kind of, I guess she's a victim of the times, right? She's a victim of everything that we've put on her. And I it just gets to a point where I get so frustrated with all that stuff and so annoyed with it and annoyed with the idea that, you know, people can't just live the lives they want to live and just go and do it. That, I don't know, I guess I'm more frustrated with that. So it's not necessarily that I can totally see that, you know, the problems and the hardships that she faces as a woman in the time. And I think it's extraordinarily well done in this movie, but it's still it's a difficult watch. Yeah. And, you know,
but there
and
is
therefore...
some fun as well. Let's not just say it's all dragging down. Like, she's quite sort of impish in this as well, in her sort of rebellion against the role that she's been forced into. You know, she breaks the fourth wall and looks directly at camera coming upstairs quite early on. She gives the finger to a dining room full of dignitaries. She, you know, chops off this hair that she is renowned for, the very symbol of her femininity and her beauty. I feel like if you watch it and sort of embrace those small rebellions that she's doing, it feels, the ending that you're talking about, which we won't spoil, feels less like a downer and more like a triumph in a weird way of her taking agency and putting her finger up at everybody. So I just really enjoyed the whole process.
I still disagree about the ending because I didn't enjoy that and didn't work for me. And I also feel like a lot of those things you're referencing felt, I realized this was the feeling of the film, just slightly not out of place, but I don't know. There was kind of a modernism to those kind of touches.
Willfully so, though, don't you think? That's the point.
I agree. I agree. Because like the soundtrack as well, you know, we've got this almost poppy singing over the top as well, created for the movie. I didn't like it. I don't know. It really struck wrong with me and felt out of place and felt, I don't know. I could totally see what it was doing. I can totally see why people would like that. But I don't know, because it's worked previously with
Marie Antoinette is period. What it reminded me of. Did you like Marie Antoinette, Sophia Coppola?
Well, yeah, I was going to say as well, there was like, what was that Kate Beckinsale movie that was kind of like modern period piece that she was in? I can't remember. Love and Friendship, that's the one. Really enjoyed that. Really, you know, it has worked for me in the past, but something about it here, I think because there, so much of it was grounded in what felt like the time and like the costuming and the way it was filmed. I don't know. Maybe I just wasn't ready for it. Maybe I wasn't ready for this film.
I think, Jack, maybe you should have had a little roast chicken and checked your male privilege at the door, baby. Maybe you need to have another go at it.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. I would say I really enjoyed the first half. And it was the second half where it just started to unravel for me a bit. So I don't know what that says.
And also, you know, we're all entitled to our own opinion. And it's great that movies make us think completely different things. So there we go. If you fancy a bit of corsage and see which side of the fence you're going to fall on, it's out in cinemas this Friday. I think it's a great film. So there. You know, like having not been that thrilled with Glass Onion and not been that thrilled with Avatar, I was thrilled to be thrilled by a film. So I love it. Okay, so now it's time to conclude the Star Wars character war for this year. This has been going on for weeks. Who was the best character in Star Wars? And he took on all comers, but the standout character who appeared in our second week and then reigned until the end was, of course, Darth Vader. No! Surprised by that, Jack?
No, because it was my pick. So.
Yeah, so. It was your pick. You brought him in and he just destroyed all competition. No one could stand up, not even Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I mean, I was surprised that he initially beat Han Solo in the first place, but he is just such a great villain. He's such an icon, especially of the series. The iconography around him is just, you know, it will last for years and decades and centuries to come. He is just one of those characters who is part of the zeitgeist and part of pop culture. And, you know, the people like Luke Skywalker, I don't know, he's the nice, naive boy, but there's something thrilling about a villain that can really just hit different. And when done well and done like this, you know, it's just, he is such a special character and creation. And yeah, I think he's a deserved winner.
Well done, Darth. You've done it. Why don't you go off and strangle somebody with the Force and, I don't know, take your helmet off, have a little rest. You've done it. Well done.
All too easy.
That is all we have time for. We'll be back next week for our final pod of the year, and then we'll be taking a break until we return in January with 2023's movies. God, so much to look forward to. Do subscribe to this podcast if you enjoy it. We love having you here every week. It feels nice and cozy, like a little community. We're in a gang. Join our gang. Before we go, though, Jack, we have a listener's question, which is apt for this week. Who's the greatest on-screen detective? Who's your fave?
Well, I'm probably going to go with someone a bit basic. I really like Sherlock. So I liked Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock in particular. I thought he was great in the BBC series. I thought it was really well done. I mean, we'll ignore the later seasons where it kind of lost its head a bit, especially him and Martin Freeman's Watson together. I thought they were really great. So I'm going to go with Sherlock. Also, he's probably the most obvious, probably the most classic, but for a reason. He's just a great character. There's so many nuances in him. There's so many complications there, whether it's him being a drug addict at times or yet still having this mind that's crazy intelligent and able to do all these wildly great things. And when one of those stories that he's in is done right, it can be a thrilling watch. Jane, how about you?
I have to agree with you. I love The Hound of the Baskervilles. That's my favourite one of those. I'm going to go classic too, I think. And I'm going to go with Poirot, Peter Ustinov's Poirot. I watched on repeat Death on the Nile, not the Gal Gadot one, as a kid. And I just love the way he sort of is, you know, befuddled. I love that befuddled. I love this about Columbo as well. You know, this sort of, the people think they've got one over and then he goes, just one moment, and then unravels their entire great plan. So Benoit, Daniel Craig's Benoit, doesn't even come close to Poirot by Peter Ustinov, with his moustache in a net at night and his bumbling demeanour and his snobbism. I love the snobbism of Poirot, that he thinks he's great. But sometimes he is wrong-footed by people. But ultimately, he always gets his guy. So yeah, it's Poirot for me. But there's so many good ones, aren't there? And hopefully, with, you know, the love surrounding The Glass Onion and various other Rian Johnson mysteries, we'll get more different and weird detectives that I love Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. You know, he's great.
A great shout. Yeah, I completely forgot that counts in this argument. Can I rescind mine?
Yeah, it can be pets. It doesn't have to be real people.
Very good.
So there you go. Those are ours. Let us know on Twitter if you have a great on-screen detective. So that's it for now, Jack. We're going to be back in January. It's time to say goodbye. Do you want to do it in your best Benoit voice or Navi voice?
Oh, man, the choice is there. I mean, I'll do it in the Navi voice because then it will just be a hiss and it'll be... That's my goodbye, Navi.
Didn't hear that.
You didn't hear it?
No.
We hear that? Are we not... Oh, man.
It's not picking up your Navi hiss.
I'm going to look up goodbye in Navi. What is it? It is Ewa Nugahu.
Nice. I'm going to say it in the style of Benoit then. Well, goodbye, ladies and gentlemen. Happy holidays.
Shut up! Shut up with that Kentucky Fried Foghorn Leghorn drawl!
Yo, listen up. Here's the story about a little guy that lives in a blue world. And all day and all night and everything he sees is just blue. Like him, inside and outside. Blue his house with the blue little and a blue Corvette, and everything is blue for him and himself and everybody around, cause he ain't got nobody to listen.
I'm blue, I've been deep, I've been down.